The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The COVID-19 pandemic has unmasked and amplified many unpleasant truths about our patchwork American healthcare system with regard to disparities in care. People of color in the U.S. are less likely to have access to timely care and have an excess death rate above what would be expected from general trends due to our systemic inequities. It's worth remembering, then, what a boon to improved health our Medicare and Medicaid programs are in the U.S. Enacted in the mid-60s over strenuous opposition, Medicare integrated U.S. hospitals and nursing homes in less than a year and has greatly lessened health disparities in parts of the country where they were most rampant. That's just one of the interesting historical stories told by my guest today, multimedia personality and multi-volume author Tom Hartman, whose latest installment of his half-dozen or so Hidden History series takes on the hidden history of American healthcare. More than just a history, Hartman lays out both a logical and moral argument for a single-payer healthcare system in the United States, a Medicare for all, along with a high-level overview of how it could be accomplished with the least dislocation to our economy. Author and multimedia host Tom Hartman is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Tom Hartman, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by just having you tell us the motivation for this particular book on the hidden history of American healthcare. It's part of a broader series of books you've done, but what led you to write this one?
Well, thank you, John. It's a pleasure being here. Over the years, I've been watching friends, family, acquaintances, people who call into my radio program, just being screwed, for lack of a better word, by our healthcare system. And back in the 80s, my wife and I moved to Germany for a year. We had sold a business and retired, and there was a international relief organization that I'd done some work with based there, and we went to just to hang out with them for a year and experienced the German healthcare system, which was largely at that time a single-payer system, and it was pretty amazing. I mean, you make an appointment with the doctor, you show up, you give them your card, and that's it. It's like we never saw a bill. I had one time I had been actually traveling into Uganda, and then I had to go to Taiwan, and then I came back to Germany, and I was just completely out of my time zones. And driving down the Autobahn, I had what probably was a panic attack. It might have had something to do with just, you know, not having had much sleep in the last couple of days and been on airplanes. But I thought I was having a heart attack, and so I drove myself to a hospital in Germany, in Nuremberg, and said, I think I'm having a heart attack. And, you know, they spent the day with me, and they did all kinds of tests and stuff and came back, and the guy gave me a 5 milligrams of Valium and said, here, take this and let's see if it goes away. And it did. Had that happened in the United States, I would have ended up with, you know, $20,000-$30,000 worth of billing. I just gave him the card and that was the end of it. There was, you know, it was so simple. It was so clean. It was just, it worked so well. And I got back here to the United States, and to do anything, I had to have my doctor, had to call my insurance company and approve everything from tests to back surgery that I had. And the contrast was just so huge. And as I learned that we were literally the only developed country in the world that has this bizarre patchwork quilt for-profit healthcare and health insurance system, I thought, you know, people need to know about this. This is just crazy. And then when I got into the history of when I started really doing the research for the book and discovered why we have our system, that was even more horrific.
Yeah. Not only did you not get a bill, I guess, in Germany, I'm assuming you also didn't get one of those very helpful explanations of benefit that we get. Those are kind of very opaque, right, difficult to understand documents. Like, this is not a bill, but there's these exorbitant charges, but much of it may be covered by your insurance, but a lot of it is coming out of your pocket. It's kind of what those things tell us.
Yeah, I never saw a single piece of paperwork. It's like there was a piece years ago I cited in the book someplace. I think it was in the New York Times, as I recall, where they compared a New York hospital. There's a hospital in New York that just by coincidence has almost exactly the same number of beds as a hospital in Toronto, Canada. And Canada, of course, has a single-payer healthcare system. They call it Medicare for all. And, you know, that covers everybody. And the hospital in New York has an entire floor devoted to billing, an entire floor with, like, you know, lots and lots of people just harassing health insurance companies for payment. And the hospital in Toronto has one office with two desks for the whole hospital.
Yeah. So one of the pleasant surprises about this book, I mean, it does say right in the title, Hidden History, And I kind of knew, I guess, from the preface, and you know, you do sort of talk about the context of this with regard to the COVID pandemic. You know, in Rahm Emanuel's, you know, and I guess he's paraphrasing others, but never let a good crisis go to waste. I think one of your hopes was that the pandemic could be something that would energize people to kind of advocate for a more uniform or equitable healthcare system. You know, I don't know if we're really getting there. It seems like we're more fractious than ever. But what I was really impressed by, because I have read a lot of things talking about a single payer system or Medicare for all, but the history that you delve into, and this is a very readable book. But you know, you go back to 1800s Germany, and that's not nearly as dry as it sounds. It's some very colorful characters. And then this Hoffman guy, I guess I was wondering if you could tell our listeners about Hoffman, who actually was a German emigre who came to the United States. I was not aware of that part of the history. And unfortunately, he had a lot of racist theories, but it sounds like some of his work in sort of public health or health statistics was actually, you know, somewhat useful. So you have to sort of separate, you know, the good from the bad here.
Yeah, Hoffman was an interesting character. He was a genius with numbers. He basically, you know, came over here with just a modest education. But he actually did the math. He got a job with the Prudential Insurance Company, which at the time was the largest insurance company in the United States. And they weren't doing health insurance at that time. It was like in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And first of all, when he moved to the United States, he married a woman from Georgia who came from a southern plantation kind of family. So there was a certain racial perspective associated with that. But he did the math early on that found the association between asbestos exposure and mesothelioma, between smoking and lung cancer. He did some really, really good work. And then he got interested in race, apparently largely through his association with his wife and some of her friends and this guy down in Georgia who had published a series of pamphlets on this theory that because black people were racially inferior to white people, which at the time was widely held and was referred to sometimes as scientific racism, that if you simply, if as a society, we were to simply deny, white society were to simply deny black people access to healthcare, that within a few generations, they would all die out. And that would solve the race problem, the post-Civil War race problem. Keep in mind, this is the late 1800s, solve that problem. And he wrote a book on this called Race Tendencies of the American Negro. He was sponsored by some groups, including the insurance company, ultimately, traveled around the country giving speeches on this. He was very, very well known. He addressed Congress on it. And ultimately, as the Prudentials started moving out of just doing life insurance and into doing health insurance, he became arguably the major voice in the United States in the 20s, in the teens, the 20s, the 30s, and even the early 40s. He died in 46 for not having a national healthcare system in the United States like his country Germany had put into place in 1884. Germany got the first single payer healthcare system in the world, and that was the Bismarck, who was, you know, very, very conservative. But it was the cheapest way to provide healthcare to everybody in Germany, and it still is, you know, anywhere in the world. It works very well. But his theory of so-called scientific racism persists literally to this day. It was the reason in the 1960s why the Southern Democrats were so opposed to Medicare and Medicaid. Was because they were concerned that this would provide health coverage to black people. And it continues to animate the discussion, particularly, you know, the discussion coming out of the conservative South. It's a pretty amazing story. And I think most people don't know it because like I said, he was very famous from the 1890s to the 1940s, but he's largely unknown today.
Yeah, and that was exactly, I'm thankful for you for writing about it and sharing that with us here, because I was really not aware of Frederick Hoffman prior to this. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and we're talking with Tom Hartman, who's a multimedia host and interviewer. He's a multi-volume author, and we're talking about his latest book, The Hidden History of American Healthcare, subtitled Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. A provocative title, no doubt. But we were talking about Frederick Hoffman. And, you know, it's interesting in thinking back, looking back on his career and his writing, as you pointed out, he had some really, you know, horrible racist theories. But in addition, you know, as you point out, he was the, you know, first to really in a significant way correlate poor nutrition or processed foods with increased cancer, as you said, tobacco and lung cancer and associations like that. But He also, it seems like, in an echo today, it seems like he trafficked a lot in misinformation about his native Germany. And this, he sort of strove to discredit this Bismarckian single-payer system that was, it sounds from your history, like it was pretty darn effective in terms of providing, you know, a basic amount of welfare. And I mean that in kind of the dictionary sense, you know, well-being for most of all of its citizens in Germany. But he was espousing kind of, you know, fake news and misinformation really from the get-go in that playbook.
It's true. And you have to keep in mind the times. You know, it was in the 1850s that Karl Marx published his writings on communism. And Marx, of course, was German. And Bismarck was dealing with, on the one hand, a rise in this communist/socialist movement in Germany and around Europe, actually. You know, the Marxist ideas were very appealing to many people. Keep in mind, this was an era of absolutely brutal capitalism. There were no unions. There was, for the average working person, life was really tough. And so on the one hand, he had that pressure. And on the other hand, he wanted to build a modern empire in Germany and make sure that he had a, you know, healthy people. And so the single-payer healthcare system was a way, because it only pays for the care, it doesn't actually provide it, like the British socialized medicine system where the government actually owns the hospitals and hires the doctors. In Germany, they didn't do that. It was just a single-payer system. You know, he could claim that it wasn't communism and yet make sure that he had a healthy country. And Hoffman then kind of recharacterized that as if it was communism, and warned Americans, you don't want to make the same mistake that Germany made. I used to live there. I was born there. I can tell you all about it. And he would say with his German accent. And, you know, it was another piece of his sales pitch that Ronald Reagan picked up in 1964 when he recorded this LP. My dad had a copy of this, actually. My dad was a Republican activist in Lansing, Michigan at the time. And, you know, it's this album where Ronald Reagan warned us all that Lyndon Johnson was going to bring communism, socialism, actually, was the word Reagan used, to the United States in the form of Medicare. And we had to stop this Medicare thing before it even got started. And he said, and if they pass this someday, we will look back, you know, someday in the future, people will look back on those times when men were free, you know, like, you know, it's just like this whole noble, you know, American, you know, rugged individualist thing that we don't need no stinking help from the government. But Reagan lost that one.
Well, actually, that's another fascinating part of the book. I was hoping you could share the LBJ, how he outfoxed the American Medical Association over their kind of strident opposition of the passage of Medicare, because that was something I also didn't know. But I knew that you know, Johnson, it was, you know, one of his signature domestic legislative victories was the passage of Medicare and Medicaid. But, you know, over this kind of pretty uniform opposition, at least from the medical lobbies, the doctors and the hospital. Actually, that's not true. The hospitals really wanted Medicare, I think, because they saw it as somewhat of a bailout.
It was hysterical. This was in 1965, and the AMA had been strongly, the AMA was a very conservative organization, and up until, I believe it was just before this that they finally integrated the AMA. There was a separate medical association for black physicians, but they were still very, very conservative and very opposed to Medicare. And Joe Califano tells the story, and I reprint a little bit of it in the book. This is from page 101. I'll just share it in his words, if that's all right with you.
Oh, please.
Yeah, sitting around the cabinet table, this is in the White House. He had invited the AMA in. Sitting around the cabinet table, the AMA officials waited politely for Johnson to say something as he settled into his chair. The president took his time, gazing at their cold stares. Then he talked about the need for physicians in Vietnam to help serve the civilian population. Would the AMA help? Could it get doctors to rotate in and out of Vietnam for a few months? He got the reply he expected. Of course the AMA would start a program immediately, the doctors responded, almost in unison. Get a couple of reporters in here, Johnson said. The president described the AMA Vietnam medical program, heaping praise on the doctors present. But the reporters wanted to know about Medicare. Would the doctors support the Medicare program? Johnson indignantly says, these men are going to get doctors to go to Vietnam where they might get killed. Medicare is the law of the land. Of course they'll support the law of the land. LBJ turned to Dr. James Apple, the AMA president. Tell him, he said. You tell him. And Dr. Apple told him, 2 days later, LBJ signed the Medicare bill.
I just love that story.
Buffaloed them.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
Well, the other really great part of your book is talking about how once Medicare was implemented, first of all, I really had no idea about the regulatory framework, because we know laws pass, but then our government agencies often then have a time to issue, you know, contemplate and issue regulations, which are really where a lot of the meat of how policies get enacted are. And Medicare did that in a very kind of compressed fashion, I don't know, six to 12 months. But once it rolled out in July of, I guess, was it 66, literally overnight, we desegregated, you know, one of the most segregated aspects of the United States. Can you share that with us, too?
Sure. At the time that Medicare went into effect, hospitals across the United States were not just highly segregated. There were a number of hospitals that just flat out refused to serve Black people at all. Other hospitals had service in their basements that were not even really all that set up for it, you know, for medical services. Some of the hospitals had separate wings or separate rooms, but they were just completely segregated, and those that actually served Black people would hire Black nurses and Black doctors. So they were, I mean, segregated from the top to the bottom. And Medicare made this illegal. Basically, it said that there will be no reimbursement to hospitals that are segregated. You have to be integrated. And the hospitals at that time, as you noted, John, were financially in trouble. It was a time of real crisis, the 60s, for hospitals, because that was, you know, the time, this post-World War II era, because of all the medical advances that came along with World War II and just, you know, the advancing technology in general, medicine had gotten much more sophisticated, much more expensive. And hospitals were, in many of these hospitals were just financially struggling. And so Medicare could represent as much as 50% of a hospital's revenue if they signed up for it and took it. And so the hospitals just, you know, money? Yes. And they jumped on it. And Califano, you know, the federal government sent out, you know, a letter to all of them saying you got to sign this letter if you're going to get the money. And the letter included the fact that they had to be completely desegregated or integrated and serve people regardless of their skin color. And the hospitals signed it. And so then Martin Luther King and a couple of other Black activists got together with the Johnson administration and created this little informal network all across the country of Black people who would go into hospitals, you know, complaining of a condition to see if the hospital was actually integrated, and busted the ones that weren't. And like you said, it was less than a year that they got every hospital in the United States fully integrated. It was literally the most successful racial integration program in the history of the United States was Medicare.
Yeah, I thought that was really awe-inspiring. And not only hospitals, but nursing homes as well. And as you point out, yep. You know, we often cite Brown v. Board of Education as this seminal moment in American history and a strike for racial equality. And yet, you know, our school systems are still vastly segregated. I mean, de facto, not de jure, but de facto. Yep.
That happened in 54, but then, you know, in 56, the Supreme Court, you know, kind of modified that decision saying, well, it has to be done with all deliberate speed, which, you know, down in the South, everybody interpreted to mean, well, maybe 40 years.
So. Right. Which, you know, 67 years later, still not happening. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is multimedia host Tom Hartman. He's also a multi-volume author. His most recent series, the Hidden History series, his current latest book is The Hidden History of American Healthcare, and we're talking about the advent of Medicare, and it's a really concise, beautifully written history with all researched and footnoted. And Tom, you are advocating this book as well as for a single-payer Medicare system, and that's not entirely new. We heard about that from candidate Bernie Sanders when he ran for president. I think Senator Elizabeth Warren and her, you make mention of that she was campaigning on that and had a sort of a simple, I guess what... One thing that your book tackled was a question that often is asked of single-payer advocates is, you know, healthcare is a huge enterprise in the United States. Like, for better and worse, you know, we employ millions of people. You mentioned these billing folks in hospitals. What happens to all those people who work in the private insurance companies if we essentially move to a Medicare single-payer system? You know, we have it was interesting, too, because, you know, many of these are publicly traded companies, right? Like United Healthcare is a behemoth. It's like the sixth or seventh largest company in the United States in terms of, I think, revenue or market capitalization. Yet I think Warren's plan or what you write about in the book would kind of solve that problem. I was really intrigued by that.
Yeah, there are ways to deal with this. We have right now five or six, depending on where you draw your line, major insurance companies. I suppose you could say as few as four, actually. You know, massive, multi-billion-dollar corporations. United Healthcare is the largest, and they spin off mind-boggling amounts of profits. United Healthcare, I believe, their profits at the end of the last quarter were about $3 billion. And in fact, their CEO, two CEOs ago, they called him Dollar Bill McGuire in the Wall Street Journal, walked away with $1.6 billion in compensation. He was followed by Stephen Jay Hensley, who walked away with about $800 million in compensation. So these health insurance companies are absolute money machines. And I believe United Health has in the neighborhood of 100 senior executives, vice presidents and whatnot, who make $1 million or more. And that's, you know, and the other ones are pretty much the same, just at a slightly different scale. And so the question becomes, you know, well, A, you've got tens of thousands of people whose job is to basically evaluate medical bills and deny payments. I mean, literally, their job is to try to figure out how to deny payments. What do you do with those people? Well, with those folks, you know, we have a huge economy with, you know, over 100 million jobs in it. I mean, I think our workforce is 115 million people right now. And there are all kinds of ways to absorb those people into the economy and basically cushions that could be provided for them, number one. Number two, what about the companies themselves? I mean, these companies spend tens of millions of dollars a year lobbying. They own politicians. You know, they owned Joe Lieberman, which is why we didn't get the public option in Obamacare. They gave him over $1 million, you know, essentially for his no vote on that. He was the deciding vote. And, you know, so what do we do about the companies themselves? You know, do we go to war with them? And what I propose in the book, and Senator Warren had brought this up at one point, was why not just buy them? I mean, you know, it's not that much money. You know, they represent, you know, arguably, you know, I don't recall the exact number. It's in the book, but it was in the neighborhood of a little less than a trillion, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was rounded number. It was about $1 trillion all in. Yeah.
So, you know, for $1 trillion, we could simply buy them, you know, just have the federal government go in and buy all the stock of these companies. The stockholders then are made whole. Nobody is injured. You know, the executives have their multi-million dollar golden parachutes already. You know, toss in a couple, you know, a few million dollars to provide a year of unemployment benefits and help for their employees and get them back into the workforce, and then consolidate all their resources into Medicare, and you know, just keep rolling along. And it's just kind of a simple and elegant solution. And, you know, and $1 trillion is a lot of money on the one hand. On the other hand, it would save the United States $1 trillion just in a matter of a few years, because these companies are skimming about 20% off the top of our, you know, our health bill every year here in the United States. And the amount of money that they're skimming off the top is just breathtaking. So, you know, if the government were to take them over, that investment would be paid back in relatively short order. And then we could have a system like Canada has, you know, which is Medicare for all, and save a fortune, just save an absolute fortune. We spend more on health insurance than literally any other country in the world. And that money is producing no benefit to us. We do not have the best health outcomes in the world. In fact, in some areas like infant mortality, maternal mortality, we have numbers that are in the areas that are typically associated with third world countries, terrible outcomes. So, you know, this would make everybody healthier. It would save the government money, and it would avoid hurting, put that in scare quotes, you know, the multimillionaires of the health insurance industry.
Tom, I want to pivot for a minute and just ask you about the series, because this Hidden History series is pretty extensive. You've done a number of volumes. And I guess I'm wondering a little bit about the genesis of it, and then how do you pick the topics? I mean, just for our listeners' sake, some of the prior ones include the Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Hidden History of Monopolies, Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, Hidden History of Big Brother in America, all about privacy and surveillance. These are some interesting topics, and if they're all as readable as this one, Hidden History of American Healthcare, I'm going to go back and look at several of them.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and then there's one on the war on voting, and I think this is the sixth or seventh in the series. I'd have to count them up. I took this idea to BK, to the publisher. They published a number of my books. And so anyhow, I went to them and I said, I'd like to do a series of books on individual topics. I had said, you know, why don't we just write individual small books, you know, the distillation of the topic with enough endnotes and footnotes that if anybody wanted to do a deep dive into any aspect of what I'm writing about, they would have all the resources they needed to do that. And I gave them a list of 10 or 12 possible topics, and they said, okay, let's try it. And so we started with guns and the Second Amendment, because most people didn't realize that the reason the Second Amendment was written the way it was at the time it was almost exclusively to protect the slave patrols in Georgia and South Carolina and Virginia. And then, you know, from there, I wanted to do a book on the hidden history of the Supreme Court. I don't think most people realize how the court has changed over the years and why, who was behind it. And then the war on voting one. The one on monopolies was the average American family spends in the United States. The average American family spends $5,000 a year more on consumer goods and services than does the average Canadian or the average European. We pay twice as much, for example, for cell phone service as pretty much any other country in the world. We pay 3 to 5 times as much for broadband. We pay massively more, you know, for pretty much everything. There are a few areas where we're cheaper, but, you know, we pay as much as twice as much for healthcare, depending on how you define healthcare and, you know, how you slice and dice it. And that's all because in the 1970s and 1980s, largely in the 1980s, the Reagan administration bought into this ideology that had been promoted by the Chicago School of Economics and Milton Friedman and his buddies and Robert Bork, weirdly enough, and changed our rules around monopolies. And so we've got basically every industry in the United States that you can name now is dominated by between 3 and 5 companies, whereas that's very much not the case in most other countries. So I wrote the book on monopolies. And then the oligarchy book, what stimulated that was the rise of Trumpism. You know, Donald Trump himself is an oligarch. He's a billionaire. And he and his friends are proposing a form of government that we have arguably only seen in the United States in the old South pre-Civil War, which was oligarchy, which is where the government is run by the very wealthy for the benefit of the very wealthy. And I think that's the big political battle that's going on right now, is oligarchy versus democracy. So that book was the last one that came out just about 5 months ago. And then the healthcare book is this year.
Well, excellent. Well, the name of the new book is The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, John. Thank you so much for having me.
Tom Hartman is a multimedia personality and multi-volume author. His latest is called The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our shows, you can always listen to them online on a smartphone, tablet, or a computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.